good. I got the applause before. I don't know if I can get it after the meeting or not. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tom. Hi, everybody. A little background on me. I know most of you from going to meetings with you locally or whatever. And some of you I don't know. A lot of you don't know my story or whatever, so bear with me. What I say today is my own personal experiences, strength, hope, and my opinion. I don't speak for anybody in AA, only for myself, so if you don't agree with me, that's fine. There's a lot of things y'all say at some of the meetings I don't agree with, but that's the way it is, and we'll go from there on. I'm a local boy that made good, I guess, by coming to drunk. I grew up in Wolftown. I was born and raised there. That's not too far from here. I don't know if everybody's familiar with Wolftown toward Gray's Mill. I'm a farm boy from a large family, last of 10 kids. 8 of us grew through adulthood, and I was the baby. That's my nickname, Baby. It was not derogatory. Go get the baby. When I got to school, all my other brothers were ahead of me or whatever, and I was known as Baby. Well, actually, Baby Marks. My last name is Marks, so I was known as Baby Marks. And I got a 30-year-old daughter that's somewhat in the area now. She's in Charlottesville, but she used to love to come down here when we meet somebody I grew up with. They say, "Hey, baby, how you doing?" And she just gets a big kick out of that. And even at the doctor's office, I have to move down here. I was going to see Dr. Shank, and I was coming down the hall, and I saw a guy by the name of Boo McDaniel. And he says, "Hi, baby." And I says, "Hi, Boo." And the doctor's wife turned around and looked at her. She says, "What the hell is that?" I said, "Oh, this is Boo McDaniel." She says, "No, his name is Thomas." And he says, "Well, this is Baby. I can't think of his name." And I said, "It's the same as yours, Boo." He says, "Oh, Thomas. Okay." So now when I go to the doctor, she comes out to the waiting room. "Hi, Baby." And so enough of that. But anyway, being the baby, I had to grow up. Lots of patched clothes, being the last of 5 brothers and all that. We were quite poor, but quite sufficient. Actually, we lived on a farm. We grew our own food, a lot of that stuff. But one of my brothers, Jaeger, was like 2 years older than me. He was an all-star athlete. He wasn't tall, dark, and handsome, but he was dark and handsome. He was a little, about 5'11", about as tall as he ever got. And he was an outstanding athlete. And I'd had some major surgery when I was in the first grade and flunked because I was in the hospital, and I wasn't allowed to play ball by my parents. So he became an all-star at everything. He was very smart, and I was mediocre at best, and was not allowed to play sports. So I grew up in his shadow. And even the teacher said, "Why can't you be more like your brother Jaeger?" You know, probably a bad thing, but he was a good guy. But I grew up in his shadow. Jaeger was an extrovert, and I've always used the example, if you took us to a party with 200 people and dropped us both off and come back a half an hour later, I'd be the little kid over in the corner all by myself and met nobody, and my brother Jaeger would have met everybody. He was outgoing, just everything I wanted to be, and I wasn't. So I was very introverted, very quiet, didn't speak very much and all that. So by not playing sports, I did hunt and fish. I became very good at that. But I turned to religion at an early age. About 12, I guess I was baptized and had become a junior counselor at a summer camp for a week or two every year. I don't know if any of you went to school here. They used to have those Bible teachers come by with the thing, with the felt things. You do the little stories on there, CBMs, Children's Bible Mission or whatever. I got quite connected with them, and through them I got used to be a junior counselor at their camps every Sunday. And it was a very heavy, dedicated Christian. Through them, I got connected with the Washington Bible College in my high school days, and I was going to become a preacher. So I didn't take any college courses to go to college because I knew I was going to go to Washington Bible College and become a preacher. You don't need French and algebra and all that to become a preacher. Done some preaching and all that good stuff. But anyway, in high school, I guess my sophomore year, I had my favorite sister contacted cancer. She was 33 years old. And I was very religious, prayed my butt off and all this, that she would be cured or whatever. She had 2 young daughters and a nice husband and a brand new home. And a year later, in 1964, she died. And me and God parted company. I had prayed and prayed and prayed, and none of their prayers were answered. And I didn't understand that because I had been lied to, because I was taught God will hear and answer your prayers. So at that point, I quit dealing with God. I pushed him out of my life totally. about the same time, I started drinking a little bit. The girl I was dating, I didn't ask because that was an unchristian to do at the time. And actually, I think the junior year in high school, I got elected president. Then they unelected me because you got to support the junior senior prom, and Tom didn't believe in dancing, so they voted me in and voted me back out. God damn, that hurt, you know. Real hard one. Anyway, I started drinking a little bit, beers and at first, and then it graduated. I've always believed liquor is quicker, and that's proved true in my life. I didn't like to waste time. I was always in a hurry. So I started drinking and worked at Exxon, back in the old days, service station restaurant for many years. I actually worked there all the way through high school from eighth grade up through senior year, and they sold beer there. I sold more beer at the back door on Sunday, which was illegal, than we did the rest of the week, actually. I don't remember selling to any of y'all. And none of the kids I grew up with have made it to AA, or most of them didn't have a drinking problem, I don't think. I was the only one that got lucky. But anyway, I remember going for an Army physical, and I worked for a small company in Orange, actually in the town of Orange, called Claristats. And I think I went for my Army physical on a Thursday. We came back, and I went to work Friday, and the door was locked. So I was out of a job. I flunked my physical, which was a good thing. Vietnam was in full-fledged at that stage. Thanks, Bill. I know you pulled your time there. I went to Washington. I had a sister live there, and I saw a sign for computer school. So I signed up for it, and I went to a computer school for a year because I didn't want to preach anymore. Continued to drink and party and all that. And I like Washington. I lived in D.C. with my sister, and people up there could drink in bars and not fight. Down here, you get in fights when you drink. You go to a dance at Stanisfield, the Greene County boys would kick your butt, more likely cut you than anything else. They were known for switching on knives in quite a bit. So I like Washington. You could go up there and drink and not get in a fight. You know, people were more sociable. So I got a job after computer school working for the government printing office, and they had an in-house cafeteria, and I didn't like it. The food sucked, so I'd go out every day at lunchtime, and the supervisor made me come back after lunch, and three or four guys that went out, she would smell our breath to see if we had been drinking, which didn't go over too well with me. That happened anyway, and the guy that ran Oak Hill back in those days had some problems, and I didn't have to quit my job. I did out of loyalty to him, came back, and ran the gas station for a year because he had some medical problems, and I didn't mind quitting. After that was over, I drank hard down here, too, and even when I was in D.C. working for the government, I'd come here on the weekends. You know, it's an hour drive or an hour and a half to come down here. And I've been drunk on almost every back road in Madison. A lot of them I don't remember, but you had to go to Charlottesville to find a bar, and it was too far and all that kind of thing. Many of the time I've been too drunk to drive, and that was just standard. I'd pull over and go to sleep in the car. And several years later, I heard a guy speaking about that, and he was very poetic. He was describing sunrise over the dashboard. I knew exactly what the hell he was talking about. I can't express it in the words he did. I wish I'd wrote it down because it was great, because I'd experienced that. And I've had many state troopers peck on the window, wake me up, see if I was alive. Other times I'd get drunk, go home, be too drunk to go in, didn't want to face the parents, so I'd go to sleep in the car and leave the car running, and my father would come out and peck on the window, and he would never say anything. My father was a drunk, too. I don't remember being drunk twice, but all the other kids remember it quite well. And by the time I came along, I guess he had enough, and he quit. But he had pulled time on a chain gang for not reckless driving. It was reckless. He tore fences and mailboxes, and that's before permits was out. So they couldn't take his permit away from him. They sent him to jail for 6 months on a chain gang. So he never gave me any hell for drinking because, you know, he had the same background. My mom's side, there were a bunch of drunks and a lot of made whiskey. So we had whiskey being made on the farm we had for many, many years, too. So I was very familiar with that. It was good. But so the drinking was there. And after I'd worked back down here on the station for a year, I went back to Washington and loved the city life. me and the farm life, to hell with that. You know, I've made enough hay, thin enough corn, chopped thistles. I don't need that anymore. You know, I got a job with the Small Business Administration as a computer operator, and did that for a few years. Drinking increased. I remember we were downtown, about a half a block from the Washington Post. We had a big computer room with plate glass windows, and across from us was a restaurant bar called the Post House. And this is back when computers were big enough. They had tape drives, and that particular time I was working on a 4 to midnight shift, and you could put a tape on. The master file was 10 mag tapes long, so you could put a tape up. It would run for an hour, maybe 45 minutes or something, then you go into high-speed rewind, you go put another tape up. So we got this down to perfection. I could get the tape rolling, go across the street to the Post House, and they'd have a beer waiting for me. And after a couple of beers, I want whiskey again because liquor is quicker, but I know how to stay somewhat sober. And I would drink the whole shift, you know, and but the work got done and all that, so... It was one night, it was a security building, too, with a car to get in and out, and we weren't. If you didn't have a car, you couldn't get in the building. And one night, I was opening the door, and this guy rushed in behind me, actually between me, and he was a very well-dressed man, and he was drunk, so I threw him out. And next day, when I went to work, my bosses called me, and they said, well, you're going to get fired today. Why? Well, that drunk you threw it last night's the deputy administrator of the Small Business Administration where we worked. I was shaking in my shoes, too. But anyway, so they go up, and they told me there's nothing they could do for me. You know, we get up there, and he didn't quite recognize me. You're the young man who threw me out? I said, well, yeah. He stuck his hand, and he says, thank you. Job well done. You're keeping the building secure. And my boss was like to faint it, and I was shaking in my boots, too. He and I became drinking buddies. Yeah, I am a GS3 operator, and he's a political appointee, you know, with an $800 suit on type of thing. And he served me well later in my drinking years, too. Actually, it's part of my story, but at that phase. And nude bars just started opening back then. And they still had everything on back then. They had halter tops and bikini bottoms and all that, but they were also close by, and I spent probably a good fortune and a lot of time at those things. We could sneak in and out time-wise. Instead of going across to the Post House, you could time it and go to a strip joint. And that became a way of life, and my drinking increased quite a bit. And I didn't lack a lot of things for what I was doing and all that kind of thing. And in 1969, we had to open another computer office in Denver, Colorado. They call it Region 8. And we went out there and set up a computer operation. And it was rough going. I think I worked like 3 months straight, getting 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night. They would bring food, and they would actually put the sandwich up and let you bite it. We had a hell of a time getting it going. We finally got it going, and Colorado was a good drinking town, too. It's the Mile High City, Denver was. And my drinking overnight doubled up. It was taking me 10 or 12 drinks back here to get a buzz on of whiskey. And out there, it was taking me 20, 25 drinks to get a buzz on. And I blamed it on the altitude of Mile High City, because if you run up the steps out there, you get out of breath. It takes several months to get acclimated to it and all that. So I didn't think about it. You know, when I go back to D.C. or whatever, it would go back down where it's supposed to. And met my first wife there. That's another story in itself, which I'll get into briefly. But I drank a lot out there, and it was just a way of life. They didn't arrest you very much for that. A lot of the policemen still wore their cowboy guns and holsters with reverse pistols like Wild Bill Hickok, and that just was always sort of weird to me. One night I was coming down East Colfax, went from north, east to west, and I had 6 cop cars pull me over, 2 beside me, 2 in front, and 2 behind me. And they didn't run me off, they just slowed down and kept slowing down. And I finally got the message and pulled over. And I got out, and I'm leaning against the car because I'm shit-faced, I guess is probably a good word. You've been drinking? What the hell do you think is what my response, you know? How much you had? And they were expecting 2 beers. And I said, let me tell you, I'll go in my coat pocket. And they grabbed me, thought I was going after a gun or something. And this particular bar, I paid up at the end of the night by swizzle sticks. How many swizzle sticks I had. That's what it would pay at. And I was a regular there. I even had a chair with my name on it. Well, I had arrived. And I had 57 swizzle sticks, and I couldn't stand up good. I had to lean against the car, and I dropped my wallet, and I fell on the cop's car. And the cop was just impressed. One of them was. He says, y'all go ahead and go on home. Leave him to me. I'll take care of this guy. And the other cops pulled away. The cop that stayed with me pulled my car over to a parking lot, which were right there. And he took me home, put me in bed. He didn't undress me. He just pulled my shoes off, and he says, you're a better man than I. He stuck the keys through a little notepad note where my car was parked with the address and bid me good night. So I got caught driving drunk a few times, but I never got arrested for it. And from that point on, I loved the Denver police. I would go out of my way to help me if I could. Again, it was still during the Vietnam era. The building that I worked in, the Region 8, was also the induction center. They were on the second floor, we were on the third floor, and I had long hair at that time, down here to my shoulders, and automatically, when you got on the elevator, they just pushed the number 2 button, and they assumed you were getting inducted or drafted, and I had many good laughs, because I'd sit on there with them, they keep looking back at me, you know, I work upstairs, and we got a lot of bomb scares. They accused me of phoning them in, because when somebody phoned a bomb scare in, we had to evacuate the building, and you go to the closest bar and drink the rest of the afternoon. It wasn't me. I would have liked to have found the guy and brought him a few drinks that did that. It was probably one of my buddies. I don't know. But it was that went on for a while. And the lady, my first wife, I worked in the building also. And we got connected. And my drinking continued. But at one stage, I played poker all night. I love poker, still do. Whenever I get a chance to play it, I will. I love to gamble. And I played poker up to about 3 o'clock, and I called in and says, I'm going to be 2 hours late. And I had plenty of annual leave. At that time, I had like 800 hours of sick leave and plenty of annual leave, so it was no big deal. But my boss had gone, and the number 2 guy, who was known as Charmin, because he became the acting boss when the real boss was away, and he put out 40 memos acting whatever his name was at the time. And he says, I've already sent the pay stubs back to Washington. It's leave without pay. And I said, you can't do that. Well, sure I can. I've done it, you know. So okay, we got an exchange of words, and half an hour later, I resigned. I showed him. I wrote the most vulgar. I think they probably still got it on display at the Small Business Administration. I spared nothing. I was very graphic what they could do with certain body parts and all that. And I've heard about that for years later because I had a lot of friends that worked at SBA. And I quit and come back. And put a few albums that I liked in the car. A popcorn pan I've had for 40 years. I still got that popcorn pan. My daughter wants it when I die. It was about the only things I bought back in Denver in the clothes. And I withdrew my retirement. I had 7 years with the SBA at the time. And I partied hardy for a year. Spent all my money. And when the money ran out, I had to get a job. And I probably spent too many days or nights on people's couches, friends of mine. And they didn't particularly like to see me coming anymore to that point, too. And on the way down here, I was thinking, on the resume, I went to work for the American Trucking Association, and when I filled out the job application, there was a thing on there, have you ever smoked marijuana? Sure I had, and I checked it. And remember the guy, Rusty Fry, he interviewed me, and he says, you're the first person I've ever seen check that you've used marijuana. He says, you've used it? I says, yeah. I says, haven't you? He says, yeah, but I wouldn't put it on the job application. I said, well, take it off the application. You put it down there. You want to know if I have? I said, yes, I have. You know, I don't particularly care for it that much, but I've done it type of thing. And he said, you're that damn honest. You got a job here. So I worked for that company for 18 years. And, for 4 years, actually, because they outsourced the whole thing to a consulting firm. I went to work for them. Then ATA took it back, and I went to work for them. So I was in the same thing for 18 years. And got in on the programming side. I've written a lot of code and design systems and all that over the years. But it I'm having another blackout. It happens a lot at my age. Used to happen long ago, too. I talked to the lady in Colorado to come in out here after getting the job with SBA, and we got married. And she wanted me to quit drinking. I remember her asking me, you need to go to AA. And no way. There was some violence in that marriage, and I only share that because it's part of the drinking. And it's nothing more disgusting than a damn man hits a woman. And I've done that. And it hurts me to even share that with you. But many of the time I'd come home, whatever, I'm going to go out drinking. She'd get between me and the door. Then next thing I know, she slapped me with an open hand. And I have always had a temper. In my older age, I've calmed down a lot. But back then, I had a hellacious temper. And I'd punch her out. And I'd go drinking. And come home, see her the next morning, she'd have a black eye, a busted lip. And damn, I would feel bad about that. And swear I was never going to drink again. I'd stay sober for a day or two. That marriage was doomed. I left her because I wanted to drink. It's just that damn simple. And we were only married 6 months. It was an expensive 6 months. Cost me a lot of money to get out of it. One thing I learned, don't get a real estate attorney to handle a divorce. I didn't have any real estate. Well, that was his first experience with divorces, too. But I was able to make amends to that lady, my first wife later, because she never knew who the hell she married, because I presented this front and the real person was here. And she was a very nice lady. And but I did make amends to her later. And my second wife, and I guess my final wife, she was back here, and she also worked at ATA back then. And she got connected with me, and she went through the worst 7 years of my drinking. And why in the hell she stuck in there, I don't know. I'm very grateful she did. I try not to get too emotional. She's helped me to stay sober very much. She's been a big part of it. Couldn't have done it without her. But if she'd have done me the way that I'd done her, I would have walked out of her in a damn heartbeat, you know. She says she saw something in me. I didn't see anything in me at the time. But she went through the 7 years of drinking. And at ATA, I was well known for my drinking. And we did computer software, and we had clients come into town, and they left it up to Tom to take them out drinking, entertain them to the nude bars or finest restaurants in D.C. I had an expense account. I ate every day, lunch on the expense account, could drink on it. We had 3 cases of whiskey delivered to me and 2 other guys every month. It was paid for by the company. And they didn't get mad about you drinking. That was part of the job. I could do it well. And but toward the end, one day I went out at lunchtime and come back. I was pretty messed up, and I had some client on the phone, and I read him the Riot Act or something, probably very vulgar. And my boss, who was also a good friend of mine, he was my hunting and fishing buddy for 31 years, I think, and he died from drinking, for what it's worth. He says, it's okay to drink. Just when you have too much, call me and don't come back. We can't have you cussing out the clients, you know. Next day, I figured I'd try it out. So I went to the same bar and called him up an hour and a half later. I said, I've had too much to drink. He said, okay, don't come back. And I did that for about a week and a half from it, I guess, and pushed it to its limit. And I had basically become the kind of person I didn't like. If you were doing what I was doing, you would be scum of the earth. I wouldn't have liked you. And I had quit drinking countless times. I could never stay quit. I could quit for a week or two. Even once I went 3 months, I think. And boy, I went out to celebrate. Had a beer, went home. Back next night, have 2 beers, went home. Back the next night, give me a whiskey. And I don't know if I got home for a few days type of thing. I woke up in some strange places with strange people. Blackouts, I didn't know were a bad thing until I got sober. You know, that to me, that was part of drinking. I puked a lot. That's a good word, puke. I don't know who invented that word, but it's... And I've upchucked stuff that would make Fornsby Furniture Stripper seem like milk. And speaking of milk, the reason I didn't go to Vietnam, I had bleeding ulcers. And I guess I cultivated those for a few years, too. I've drank melted butter because every time I drank, I would bleed. And even sometimes when I didn't drink, I'd bleed. I would even melt butter and drink because I heard that would coat your stomach. There was another drink, a white Cadillac. You put milk in scotch or whatever. It was supposed to coat your stomach. But I found the answer. Just do a triple noun. Don't even let it hit the sides of your throat. The pain goes away, and you take your shots at it. I've been in the hospital from losing blood, and was told then, young man, if you want to live, quit drinking and get 8 hours sleep a night and all that, and I ignored that. But anyway, back to where I became the person I couldn't stand. I was putting a shotgun in my mouth, wanting to commit suicide. At first, the suicide was going to run into a bridge doing, 100 miles an hour, and the family get the insurance. I'll go over to this, break a box and grab one and get electrocuted, and they get my life insurance. But the inside hurt so much that I can't take this anymore. The shotgun's going to go. And I'm a hell of a good shot. With the shotgun in your mouth, 12-gauge, double-aught buck, it's hard to miss. And I wanted to die. I didn't want to die. I was scared. Cried quite a bit, and my wife wasn't around at that time to see her or something. Well, she was around, but these nights when I was having those episodes with the shotgun, she wasn't there. And I remember going in to see my buddy and my boss. I told him I needed help, and he says, it's a good thing, because if you'd have screwed up today, we were going to fire you. And he says, if you're willing to get some help, we'll do that. And I had pretty good insurance, and I had to go to a psychiatrist, which I had a hell of a time with, because psychiatrists deal with crazy people. You know, it was my concept. But in order to go to a treatment center, I had to get a psychiatrist to sign off on it. And he didn't ask me about my childhood or any of that. He just asked me how much I drank, and I told him. And he was impressed, too. But he says, I think you should go to AA, and you need treatment. And they tried their damnedest, including my boss, to get me to go to an inpatient thing, and I didn't think I was that bad because, again, I was comparing out. We had a lot of winos in Washington who slept on their grates during the wintertime and drank, and that's what I considered an alcoholic, not me. But I was. So I went to an outpatient treatment center of the Arlington Hospital. And I remember one thing stuck with me from day one. They said, we'll teach you about your disease of alcoholism. You'll have to go to AA to stay sober. We can't do that for you. And they took my expense account away. I no longer got free lunches, which hurt greatly. They were trying to protect me, and they did. They just didn't even let me go out to lunch with the guys that I drank with every day and all that. But I missed those free lunches. We ate in some nice places. But it was very difficult to stay sober and to be around other people drinking or whatever. But I did. I remember lying to the treatment center lady, the counselor. You know, she'd get a sponsor, and after 3 or 4 weeks of riding me, I did. And went back and told her, and what's his name? Roger. What's his last name? I don't know. It's an anonymous program. She bought that or didn't give a damn. I don't know which, one of the two. But anyway, and I had to go to AA a couple of weeks and get papers signed that I was going and all that. And I did that. The first year of sobriety was hard. I just didn't want to drink anymore because I would kill myself, but I didn't want to buy into the program. Let me go back a little bit prior to that. No, back in the early days of ATA. I went to two meetings in 1980. I forgot to mention that. I've been sober since April 7th, 1982, so I've got about 34 and a half years. And a little bit 2 years prior to that, I went to two AA meetings, and I heard God, 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 and I thought Jerry Falwell was leading the meetings. And at that stage, that's when not too long after my sister died type of thing, I wanted nothing to do with God, so I went back out. But after those 2 years of being out, had no questions left. I was an alcoholic. I needed help. I was willing to do whatever it took to get the help. And so I just want to go back and mention that. But after a year of AA, because I wasn't really participating, I cleaned ashtrays, helped set up chairs and do things like that, but I didn't connect with anybody. I was miserable. I guess it's basically, white knuckling it, even though I was going to a few meetings and all that. I hadn't met anybody. A couple of people knew my first name, but other than that, but I remember going down. Everybody went to IHOP there. They had a bottomless cup of coffee. You could get one pot and let 40 people drink on it all night long. And I'd go down there, an AA table would be back there, and I'd be up about four tables by myself. And I remember this guy, Woody Nye, came by one night. He says, why aren't you back with us? And I says, nobody invited me. He says, we don't know your goddamn name. He says, Thursday, get your hand up and tell us your name. What is your name? I says, Tom. So Thursday, I got my hand up, and my name is Tom. I don't remember if I said I was an alcoholic or not. And everybody said, hi, Tom. And then next time we went down to IHOP, come on back here, Tom. We joined them. So that was a big part of it, and drinking coffee with other people. So that's how it started. Anyway, at the end of a year, I was white knuckling, and I got to what our turning point. If this is all there is to staying sober, I might as well go to hell and get drunk. I was miserable. And I guess if there is a God moment, that might have been it. I got a sponsor, and I got the right one. He was bigger than me. He had a meaner look in his eye, and he slightly intimidated me, type of thing. And I asked him, and little did I know, maybe HP did put him there. I don't know. He was a step Nazi, and he trained me well. And now I'm a step Nazi, and don't apologize for it. But he was a good guy. I heard Friday night somebody said at a treatment center meeting they worked all 12 steps this one night. They read them all, and they did them in their head. And I can relate to that, because when I went to the treatment center, I worked all 12 steps in a few weeks, and I had no idea what the hell I was doing. But when I got the sponsor, we worked the steps at his pace, and his method was you read the first step of the big book for 30 days, and then we'll talk about it. And if you miss a day, you got to start back with day one. And I think I got down through maybe the second step or third, one of the long steps, and I was down to day 29, and I missed a day, and like an idiot, I fessed up, yep, I missed a day. It put me back to day one, reading all that again, but it worked. It taught me to follow directions and that type of thing. So the steps were a big part of my life, and I remember him for one thing. He says, if you look around these AA rooms, and the people that are happy and half as well adjusted are the people who work the steps. And I personally believe that. You know, it's not written in law, it's not carved in stone, but that's one of those things I believe and don't want to force it on anybody else, but it's been true in my case. And I was with him for 5 years, and I've had another sponsor for 20-some years. And I'm a big believer in sponsoring people. We call them pigeons where I come from. I got sober in Arlington, Virginia, basically. And that was just their terminology, is pigeons. It's not derogatory at all. It means you carry the message, like a pigeon from World War One or whatever, flying with messages. That's part of the AA thing. We carry the message. Pigeons flock together. Eagles fly alone and get drunk. You know, I guess the eagles get drunk. It's been a great thing for me. I remember a very common story, the meeting I went to. I went to one meeting, well, twice a week for 29 years. I mean, other meetings, too, but that was my home group at Westover in Arlington. And we had a guy there, Grateful Pete, was his name, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And it's typically the first few years it makes everybody sick when they hear that, but I also attained that at some point. I'm grateful that I'm an alcoholic, and I'm grateful I'm sober. It's the best damn thing ever happened to me. But it's just been a tremendous ride. I've had some ass kicks in life, in sobriety. It's life, you know. But there's been nothing good enough or bad enough for me to take a drink over yet. I think about it occasionally. Every once in a blue moon, I can taste whiskey in my mouth, and I start salivating, and I got to think it through. What I would give up. Haven't had a cigarette in almost 30 years. That's neither here nor there, but I sort of use the same philosophy. If I have one, I'm going to have a carton before I get home, type of thing. And I bring that back to a little memory thing, too. A guy, Arthur, told me, because we were fighting whether it's the first drink or the 57th that would get you, in my case. He told me about the guy who got hit by a train. Is it the engine that kills you or the caboose? And I'm smart. It's the caboose that hits you first, so that's what kills you. And Arthur looks at me, young man, it don't really make a damn. You're still dead either way, you know. And I got what he said. Arthur also taught me one other thing. This is a character-building program. It took me a few years to figure that one out on my own. But when you work on your character defects and get rid of them, you're building character. And I've been doing that for a long time. But my first sponsor taught me something, and I still do. He cycled me through the 12 steps annually. With him, I had to go through 12 steps every year. And the people I sponsor got to go through the steps every year. So I get probably an overdose of the steps, and it hasn't hurt me yet, you know, for myself and for them. I remember a book I read, New Pair of Glasses. I think that's what the book says. We've got to find new ways to work the same old 12 steps. And I believe that because I'm not the same person I was 5, 10 years ago or yesterday type of thing. I've become a more calm person. Some of us do to getting older. When I got here, I didn't have any gray hair. Now I have gray hair and some of it's gone and my beard is white, but that's okay. I've earned that type of thing. But sponsoring people has been one of the greatest blessings I've ever had. You cannot pay me a better compliment than saying, ask me to be your sponsor. I got a spiel I go through when I sponsor somebody. Part of it is, don't waste my time. You know, money, cars, a lot of things can be replaced. I give you my time, especially my age now as I'm getting older, that can't be replaced, you know, so don't waste my time. If you don't want to work the steps, get somebody else to sponsor you. I don't have a problem with that. No. You know, I don't get offended. And I've had people, no, I don't want to do them your way. Okay, go somewhere else and do it, whatever. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. I've had some pigeons get drunk over the years. I've had quite a few of them die from alcohol-related illnesses. And I've had some of them touch my soul. Sorry. And I'm sure I've touched a few people's souls. That's what makes this thing work. We give it away. I'm a firm believer you've got to give it away to keep it. And there's many ways of giving it away. It can be through sponsorship, showing up. When I go back to Westover, I still got pigeons up there I sponsor. And somebody would be sitting in my chair. When Tom shows up, they get the hell out of the corner seat. That's Tom's chair. You know, they let me sit there. And it's pretty neat in a way. But I miss that home group, too. I came down here about 6 years ago, I guess. Moved down, had a home built, and had 29 years of sobriety, and I was just as scared as the damn day I got sober. All you people I don't know, a bunch of weirdos and all that, and turned out it was true. So am I. But I've gotten to know most of you, and I like you, and you're a big part of my sobriety. But it was hard. In Arlington, I had history. I had prestige. You know, I sponsored a lot of people and had lots of buddies and all that kind of thing. And down here, I didn't have nothing. Had AA, and it took a while. And I remember going down to Rapidan's, a guy, John Sprinkle. He and I got very close. He died on me, too. Not on me, but I wish the hell he was still alive. He touched me greatly also. We're kindred spirits. And I went down there, and he found out Brian lived across the field from me or whatever. And I didn't know that. And he said, well, you need to connect this guy. He lives right up across the field from me. And thank God, John knew Wolftown. And so Brian and I got connected. But I went to one meeting, I think, down in Rapidan. Then I had to go back to Arlington for one of my guy's anniversaries. So I didn't make it the next week down there. Somehow John got my home number and called me up. You okay? Yeah, why? Well, I didn't see you. I said, I only missed one meeting. He said, yeah, but we were wondering where you were at. And he didn't know how long I'd been sober either at that stage or whatever. He might have thought I was brand new. But it touched me. After one meeting, he gave a damn. He called me up. And he taught me a few other things, too. And he taught me one thing about prayer. He said, I don't ask God for anything. I just thank him every day when I get up. God knows what I need. I don't have to ask him for it. And whether that's true or not, I don't know. I've had a God problem since day one, and I'll share that with you. I'm not an atheist. I'm not an agnostic. I'm just confused. I don't have a damn clue what God is, where he lives, what he looks like. When I got here, a guy, Michael P., says, your higher power. It could be Darth Vader, Rubby Ducker, or Rubby Ducky, or Doorknob, as long as it's not you. And I understood that. And so I allow for any possibilities. My first sponsor, who was an accountant, said it takes 11 seconds to ask God, he have to keep you sober every day. I've done that every day so far. I have enough respect for this program and the people in it that I pray twice a day. At nighttime, I thank God for the day of sobriety. It may fall on the empty universe, I don't know. But I'm an old poker player, and sometimes you got to cover your bets. What the hell it boils down to. I've learned a lot of good things in AA. And it hasn't been so much in AA. It's just from talking to the people in the parking lots over a cup of coffee and people who have more wisdom and are smarter than I am. And there are quite a few people that meets that. I thought I knew everything when I got here. I'm still learning. That it's what I like, I hope to hell, as long as I'm physically able to get around, I keep coming back. That's 40 years of sobriety, 50 years I'll take and run with it. I don't like to see people get sober with long-term sobriety and they quit going to meetings, even if they stay sober. You know, I want to learn as long as I live, and I enjoy it. The joke I tell behind my wife's back is, if she knew how much fun is happening at these meetings, she'd make me quit coming. You know? It's a joke, dear. but it's true, and I have met some of the finest damn people I've ever met in my life. I've also met some SOBs that I want to get associated with. You know, everybody in AA is not good. Just because you quit drinking doesn't make you a good person. Hopefully, they will become good people in their lifetime, but I want everything this program has to offer, and I'm still learning, still finding ways to do things, and I enjoy it. One of the blessings that I've got about AA itself is when going to a meeting became something I wanted to do rather than something I had to do, and in the 34 years, I've walked out of 3 AA meetings. It was just so damn depressing I couldn't take it anymore. It's not because one person was sharing something that I couldn't take. It wasn't that. Just, I hate depressing meetings. And then I felt guilty about leaving those. What if the message came from me and I wasn't there to hear it? So I've sat through a lot of rotten meetings from my perspective to hear the message. I didn't hear it other than every time I go into a meeting, whether I'm feeling good or bad, I go home feeling better. It has not failed me yet. And that's been one of the blessings. So being a drunk was the best thing that ever happened to me because I wouldn't know any of you if I never had a drink in my life in other meetings. I feel blessed that the people in Northern Virginia I got sober with. I have many, many friends up there and down here. I'm doubly blessed. And I've got some friends from my drinking life, too, that I still keep contact with and all that. But the God thing, I don't know. I'm comfortable with it. It's the God of my understanding. But I firmly believe in praying twice a day, and I ask God to help keep me sober in the morning. I got other list things I ask help with, and I get them. Part of my little thing is I like to go through my take on the steps. It's a little different from some people, and I get dirty looks from some people and all that, but I pass on what was passed on to me, and obviously it works because I'm still sober. It's not the only way. I've seen other people work it. That was another lie my first sponsor told me. If you don't work the full step, you'll get drunk. There was a guy, Lee the locksmith. He had 7 years when I had 2. And he died probably with 40 years of sobriety, and I don't think he ever worked the full step. We had another guy, a biker, heavy-duty biker, bad dude. Four-step Calvin every year. See, Tom, I got another year, and I haven't had to work the four-step. You don't have to work it for me. That's fine. I don't care. It's up to you. When he had 20 years of sobriety, he came to me, he sort of bowed, he said, Tom, I'm fine doing the steps. And he says, I should have done them 20 years ago, that four step that you always push a lot. And he says, I was afraid. Big, heavy, ass-cooking biker dude was afraid. And I'm sure he's been in many a damn fight I wouldn't want to be in or whatever. I wouldn't want to mess with him. But that sort of separates the men from the boys or the women from the girls or whatever. I don't know. It's personal opinion again. But I'll go through my take on these. I push these things to hell and back. With many of our pals over alcohols and our lives have become unmanageable. I remember sitting on a bar stool wanting to help Richard Nixon run the country, and I couldn't run my own damn life. He didn't do too good a job either, actually. He got kicked out. But I had a hard problem with being pals over alcohol. And one of my pigeons later on got into, we may be powerless, but we're not helpless. I like that. I'm powerless over people, places, and things, but I get to participate in my recovery and maybe somebody else's recovery. So take part in that. Came to believe that a power greater than itself could restore us to sanity. I had a hard time admitting I was insane. That was explained to me in the treatment center. If you drank Pepsi and if Pepsi made you shoot the TV screen out and you kick your dog when you drink Pepsi, what would you do? Quit drinking Pepsi. So, well, that's insane. That clicked with me. It made sense. Number 3 is probably where I had the biggest problem again due to the God thing, even though they underline as we understood him. The way I was taught and the way it works fine for me, and I pass on to the guy that's sponsoring, we made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understand it. To me, It's nothing more than making a decision. No more than that. If you want to get into the third step prayer and all the other stuff, fine, go for it. I don't have a problem with that. But the way I was taught, you make the decision, and it's how you implement steps 4 through 12 is how you implement that decision, how you carry it out. In fact, in the morning, I asked God to help me keep sober. I'm asking for help, and it's up to me to do the rest type of thing. Number 4 was an ass-kicker for me. I don't know. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory. I got more help guys from Hazleton, from every AA group I could, and it was very fearful. It sort of boiled down to my sponsor to point out, Tom, you worried about step 5. You're not there yet. You're on step 4. And all you do is make a list. And it was still hard. It took several months for me to do that. I'd sit down with pencil and paper. And thank God he was a big believer in pencil and paper. None of the stuff on floppy disk. One of my pigeons did all this on floppy disk, and he got an error and ate it all. He had to put it back on paper later. But after I got it done, we got together for step 5 and admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being. I know God won't rat on you. He don't talk behind your back. You know, you can get away with whatever. He doesn't do that. Tell another human being some of the bad things I've done, some of the dumb things, the idiotic things. That's just as embarrassing as some of the bad things I've done. You know, damn, fess up. I had a problem with that. But in order to get some of the things, because I remember in AA, I may be out of whack here, step 9, when you're halfway through, the promises start coming true. I remember hearing the promises when I first came into AA, and they just seemed so far-fetched. I wanted them, and they were far to reach. But so, and I knew that somewhere between halfway nine, they start step 9, they start happening, so I wanted to get down to that. We're entirely ready to God, have removed all these defects of character, and humbly asked him to remove them. And again, my sponsor lied to me. He says, God will remove your character defects. And I went through steps 6 and 7, and the next day I had all my character defects. I've been lied to. I found out over the years, God may remove them, but I got to do all the damn work. You know? I guess that ties into God will move mountains, so you got to show up with a shovel. And I'm a firm believer in that. You know, I got to do the work. Is later on in some of the steps, it talks about what God will do and not do for you, I think. Made a list of all persons we'd harm, became willing to make amends to them. I was told, well, you're doing step 4, keep that, and that's where you can get the names from. And I was also told to put my own name on there because that harmed me greatly. Made direct amends to people wherever possible, except when to do so injure them, and did that. Some of them was hard. I know the one with my father was very damn difficult for me to do. I guess a lot of guys have trouble dealing with their dad or whatever, but I got through it. Most of them went well. I had a few people tell me, I won't ever see you again. Get the hell out of my life. Okay. Bye. And that was okay. I put forth my shot. Pretty much do a step 10 every day in a sense. My life is very simple now, but I still like more often before I go to sleep to just go through the day, see what's happened. But when we're wrong, promptly admit it, that's good. Again, that may be part of my age. As I get older, I don't want to suffer. I don't want to be miserable. I want to get whatever the hell's bothering me done and over with. You know, even if you got to eat crow, apologize. I screw up less than I used to, but I just don't want to be miserable for a long time and let that go. So I take that and I promptly admit it. Get on with it. Sought through prayer and meditation. I still got hung up on meditation for a long time. And the best thing I do with that was heard prayers when you talk to God, and meditations when you shut the hell up and let God talk to you. Just be quiet, be still. And I read a lot of books that are spiritually related, you know, by various authors of whatever and type of things and all that, and that helps. And I'm a firm believer in step 12, haven't had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I've had many spiritual awakenings over the years, and I still go through the steps, and I still learn. Things come out at me. I have one daily book that I read. It's not conference approved. It's a Hazleton Touchstone book, daily reflection thing. I've been reading that for about 28, 29 years, and I like that book. What amazes me is I remember reading something a couple of years ago, and now I read it again. I remember it, but it takes on a new meaning because I'm not the same person I was back then type of thing. I'm getting close to running out of time. So anyway, that's about the 12 steps. But some of the things I've learned in general, I don't allow people to rent space in my head. You know, I don't, to hell with them. I remember my wife, one of the companies she worked for several years ago, got into a bunch of tapes. I don't know if you remember those or not. I had positive thinking. I got to listen to those tapes. I made copies of them. I don't know where the hell they are now, but I did. And I got into positive thinking, not through AA, but it has helped me tremendously. I used to prepare for the worst. I can take it and brace for the hit. Sure enough, it would come. It's like seeing the shit happen bumper sticker. You don't see that on a Cadillac. You see it on old Fords and Chevys that are rusted out and banged up fenders. It's attitude, how you look at life, you know, and set goals. I didn't believe in setting goals because you never attain your goal. We always fall short. But that set of tapes I got in there, at least when you get back up to start up again, you're pointed in the right direction. I like that, you know, type of thing. So I expect the best. I get disappointed a lot, but I can deal with that. I hear you can have expectations but don't plan the outcome. Everything I've ever done, I plan the outcome. Why plan if you can't have an outcome? Every poker hand I've ever called, I plan to win. Don't win them all, but it doesn't mess with me for long to the next hand. I'm ready to go again. Same thing at a racetrack. I love horse racing. Every time I bet, I expect to win. I get disappointed awfully, and it's only in 5 or 10 minutes where we get disappointed again type of thing. But I don't let it destroy me. You know, I have a blind faith. No matter what I do, as long as I don't take a drink, it's going to be okay. Now, whether God's in that, I don't know. It's just been a good thing in my life, and I am truly blessed by the people that are in my life. I used to use the word lucky. I don't even use that in poker anymore. You know, it's I'm blessed is the word that comes to my mind. I'm just a better human being for knowing each and every one of you. And this lady, Katie Bailey, said, you know, people are strangers. She says, don't look at them as strangers. They're just friends you haven't met yet. Mm-hmm. Katie taught me how to hug. When I got here, I didn't hug no damn body. Now I'm giving Billy Hill hugs, so you can tell me. I don't know if that's progress or not, but Katie, I would stiffen up, and she was an older lady, and she said, I'm going to keep hugging you till you can learn to love yourself, and I understood that, and it took a few years for that to happen. I love me. I think I'm a nice guy. Some people disagree, and that's okay. It's just, again, I am truly grateful, and if you can get up in the mornings with gratitude and have gratitude, that's been a blessing, because if you're miserable, you can't be miserable and grateful at the same time, I don't think. They coexist at the same time. So, and I'll mention one thing because it slipped my mind about the character defects. The method I used on that was the old post office box, the little pigeonholes with the dials, things, you know, 20, 30 boxes. If you take the character defect out, you need to insert the character asset, and that's the way I was taught. You try replacing the defect with an asset. Because if you don't put anything back in there, the same defect slides right back in type of thing. So it's been a constant battle. I jokingly said lately, you know, I've been doing this 34 years. I must have really been screwed up because I've been working on me for that damn long, and I still, there's no perfection. I got things I want to do and change and like about me. And there are people in AA who still got stuff I want. If you want what somebody else has, then you need to do what they do. And one guy who we didn't have Doc Johnson up there, but we had some other guys. Old man Mac came to mind. Don't take a drink. Go to a meeting. Pray and don't shit yourself. And he would leave that to you. I had to figure out that last statement part there. But it's true. So thanks for being in my life, and I'll shut up and get out of your way here. Thanks.